Hello, and thanks for listening to the Kept Faith Podcast. I'm Nick McCann. I'm joined by Travis Russell.
Hey, go Padres. We're on some kind of streak right now.
Yeah.
Hopefully we can keep it going.
Yeah, this is a lot of fun. It's just I expect them to win all the time. And
we've become accustomed to it. It's maybe dangerous, but I'm accustomed to winning now, Nick.
I'm ready to be spoiled. I deserve to be spoiled at this point. You know, I've gone through a lot as a lifer, and I want my hopes up, and I'm ready to just go on this journey. Apparently, they're losing right now, but that we don't have to talk about that. That's it's just a Tuesday night against the Brewers, but
plenty of time left. Plenty of time.
Well, we have a really special guest today. Barry Bloom from Sportico is with us today. How you doing, Barry?
I'm great, guys. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah.
It's awesome. Yeah. Thanks for being on.
Yeah. Thanks for coming on. You know, I've been following your writing for a long time. What got you started, in journalism, and who were the guys that blew your hair back when you were choosing that way of life?
Well, like I grew up in New York, and like I always tell everybody, when I realized that I wasn't going to replace Mickey Mantle in center field for the Yankees, yes, I figured I needed another way of getting into the sports business. Uh-huh. So I just started at my high school newspaper. I covered fencing, cross country, whatever they wanted me to do. Eventually became sports editor, sports director of the radio station, sports editor and editor of the paper in college, and also sports director of a radio station when I did my master's at San Francisco State. So, you know, it was an easy way. I could write, I couldn't play. So it was a good way of getting into it.
Yeah. And what year did you get to San Diego?
I was hired to cover the old San Diego Clippers. And I started on the day of like 1982, the 82-83 Clippers season. And then they put me onto the Padres part-time in the summer of 83, when Dick Williams was the manager and they wanted me to stir up a bunch of shit. And so then I was on them, you know, pretty regularly until the papers merged. And then I went over, did sports business beat over on Newsside at the merged paper after a year still in sports there. So that's pretty much my tenure, the nutshell of my San Diego existence.
Yeah. So you're covering the team in 1983, the year before they go to the World Series. What do you remember about the 83 team? I feel like we talk a lot about the 84 team, but were there signs that this could be going in a positive direction like that?
Well, the 83 team, you know, had Garvey. It didn't have Nettles. It didn't have Gossage. You know, those were all things that happened before the 84 season. So, you know, it was back-to-back 82 and 82 teams with Garvey there the first 2 years. And the first year he broke broke the record for most National League games played, 1,207. And, you know, it seemed like he was going to be on that way. You know, that wasn't the record he broke, but that's how many he eventually had before he dislocated his thumb, sliding into home plate in the middle of the 83 season, and got knocked out for the rest of the season. And to me, I don't think he was ever the same. You know, he never had the swing, the pop in his swing that he had before the injury. But, you know, be that as it may, there was a lot of transition going on in 82 and 83 to get to the 84 team.
Yeah. Hey, and for the listeners, if you guys want to hear more of Barry talking about Steve Garvey's Hall of Fame case, I just checked out a pod called Pod of Fame that he just did, where they had you on to talk about his career and, you know, whether or not he should be in the Hall of Fame and all that. You know, I think he should be. But that's a good podcast to check out. He goes more into depth about Garvey on that. It's on your Twitter, at Boomski.
So. He's a slam dunk Hall of Famer as far as I'm concerned. And why he was not voted in.
Well, I was growing up in Claremont during that time, and I was four or five, and he was so much bigger than anybody else on the team for the kids. We all wanted to be Steve Garvey. I had no idea. I couldn't put it together that he was a Dodger before that. I just thought he was the greatest Padre of all time. And I didn't have any sense of time, but
what part of Claremont?
I was west of Genesee.
Oh yeah.
South of Balboa.
Yeah. We
were that little right there.
Right below Claremont High School for a long time.
Oh, cool. Yeah. I lived off of Mount Everest basically.
Okay.
Yeah.
My mother-in-law still lives over there on Claremont Mesa Boulevard in Limerick.
Oh, okay. Cool.
Oh, by the 805.
Yeah. You and Major Garrett, I guess, grew up over there.
I didn't grow up there, but I grew up in the Bronx, as I said.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. Sorry. Claremont. It's a Claremont town, but the thing about the Padres now that is really interesting is it does feel like they are headed towards something. And what are your thoughts on Bob Melvin? It seems like, you know, the Padre fans, who can be prickly. I think you know that, but this hot start that we've gone on has been much credited, I think rightly so, to Bob Melvin kind of riding the ship. I mean, you wrote something in February of 2020 about the first presser that you went to with Jace Tingler when he was being introduced. And there was parts of that article where you were talking a lot about little things that you noticed about how the team wasn't really hiding his inexperience and certain things that they were going to have to cover for him. It seemed like you were onto something on that, I guess. It didn't really work out. But what are your thoughts on Bob Melvin? And do you think a manager can really make that change happen?
Oh, I love Melvin. I mean, he's a good friend. Now, I covered him as a player with the Giants. You know, when he managed out here, I live in Phoenix, and we managed out here with the Diamondbacks. We were pretty close. Mm-hmm. You know, while we were with the A's, you know, I didn't cover the A's much over the course of time, except an errant playoff game or something like that. And we've always had a great relationship. Look, I was a big proponent of them bringing Bochy back to manage the team so that, and Bochy would finish up his career in San Diego. And I think, you know, Bochy wanted to do it, but they couldn't come to terms on it. They talked before Tingler, they talked before Melvin. I didn't realize that, you know, the A's were going to be that stupid to let Melvin walk away in their whole rebuild, especially since they had him under contract. But hell, the Padres let Bochy walk away too. So, I mean, and look at how that worked out. You know, they haven't been to the playoffs in a non-COVID season since then. So, to me, you know, if you couldn't have, and I told AJ about this, I just said, if you couldn't have Bochy, Melvin would have been my number one choice. And I just didn't know he was even available. You know, the fact that they made contact and, the A's said, yeah, sure. You know, it was basically like when the Giants made contact with Sandy Alderson and they said, yeah, sure, go ahead, Boch. And then they offered him a 3-year contract and Bochy went back to the Padres for an extension. And Alderson said, you know, you have a contract for one more year. I can't guarantee you're going to be extended or back next year. So if you want the 3-year contract, take the job. And I think it's the same thing with Bob. I mean, to me, a lot of the Padres' problems of not getting started over the last few years have been the fact that, you know, you can't have a 5-3 manager in like Green or Tingler in the clubhouse who has never played in the major leagues. You know, Green never played in the major leagues. At least he coached in the major leagues, you know, part-time, a little bit with the Diamondbacks before he came over to the Padres. But Tingler never did anything. I mean, I remember I was aghast when I asked him at that press conference, you know, what kind of managing experience have you managed anywhere, Little League? And he said, no, I've managed a lot of games in my head. And I go, this is not good. This is not going to be good.
Yeah, and, I remember that.
And AJ basically said, are you going to rip us? And I go, no, but I'm going to rip you. Uh-huh. And to his credit, AJ has a pretty thick skin. We get along great. And, you know, what I just told you about Tingler and Green on the air, I just exactly told AJ the same thing during spring training. He said, well, they were nice guys. And I go, yeah, but Manny and Hosmer walked all over them. Now that's over. You know, they had Tatis by the nostrils. You know, it was a terrible situation. I still don't know what happened with that whole Machado-Tatis confrontation last year in the dugout in St. Louis, but it wasn't good. And Tingler had no control of the situation. Neither of them had control of the clubhouse. And the one thing you're going to have with Bob, you know, Bob has experience. He knows how to manage. He's a catcher, which always makes great managers.
Yes.
Backup catchers, because they sit on the bench a lot with the manager and they learn how to manage the game. Plus, they've had to handle pitchers. They have to hit. They have a rounded view of baseball that other players from other positions do not have. So it's like, you know, they're not going to push Bob around in there, nor are they even going to try. So I think it's a great situation, and it'll be interesting to see once Tatis comes back from his injury, how he fits into the whole situation and stops acting like the prima donna he is.
Hmm. Yeah. And when you know, you got into some, I guess, hot water, not that you took it that way, but with Padres fans, when you evaluated Tatis as a prospect before he came up, what is your thoughts on Tatis now? I mean, obviously the talent is jaw dropping when he's healthy, but it seems like the biggest problem with him is whether or not he can stay on the field. I mean, how has your opinion of Tatis changed since you made that first evaluation?
Okay. So, you know, just for the background of what happened there, you know, it just happened to be in Fort Wayne to see some family, and we all went over to a tin cup or whatever the names are game.
Tin caps.
And Tatis had a brutal night, struck out with the bases loaded, threw a ball away, a couple of balls away. So I said, you know, I made an aside about Tatis in a tweet. And I go, well, it's lucky they have such a nice ballpark here. I'm not real impressed by Tatis.
Yeah.
And that started a whole Twitter storm. And then as soon as that started, I just figured, oh man, this is great. I'm just gonna tweak Padre fans endlessly about this. And in fact, you know, like Tatis finally answered one of the tweets back. The next year, oh, he's batting 186 right now at the end of April. What do you think now, Padre fans? And, you know, and Tatis answered back and said, I'll see you in September. And I thought, this is hysterical. Now he's playing in the Futures game as a Padre minor leaguer. And, you know, I go up to him to interview him. And I said, look, I just want you to know this has nothing to do with you. All I'm doing is tweaking the Padre fans. Yeah. I'm just having a good time with Padre fans. And it's like, are you kidding me? I mean, when I covered the team back in the 80s, I used to get so much mail of people ripping the hell out of me. You know, there was no internet. There was no ESPN. There was, you know, there was no Twitter or social media. But I used to get, you know, emails and all kinds of stuff ripping the hell out of me.
Back in the day when you had letters, they had to really put in the effort, right? If
one Padre fan on Twitter thought they ever got under my skin about Tatis, I have a lot thicker skin than that.
Yeah.
I mean, Dick Williams locked me out of his office for a month in 1984 because he didn't like something I wrote. I mean, let's be real here. So I said to tell Tatis this, and he just started laughing. He goes, hey, don't worry about it. And I get along great with Tatis.
That's great.
You know, it's like, to your point, right after the Futures game, I think he slid into second base, head first, dislocated his thumb in the minor leagues and missed the rest of that minor league season. Then they, you know, the Padres had, I don't know if they still do it, but they had a minor league system game at Petco after the season.
It's called the Don Wilkie Classic.
Yeah, exactly. Now it's called the Don Wilkie. Yeah. Was still alive at the time.
Yeah.
But, you know,
it's true.
I watched Tatis go from first to home, and I go, beside Deion Sanders, this is the fastest guy I've ever seen on a baseball field on the base pass. And so it's like, his hitting, fielding, all that, I still think his number one, you know, attribute of a five-tool player is how fast he is on and how smart he is on the base pass. I mean, he obviously, he's a prodigy. His father played in the major leagues for many years. He was around the game, you know, much like Tony Gwynn Jr. with Tony Gwynn. You know, there's a lot of Barry Bonds with Bobby Bonds. I mean, there's a lot of that. Ken Griffey Jr. with his father. There's a lot of that over the course of the years. And I think Tatis benefits from that. Mm-hmm. But I think you, to your point, he's got to stay healthy because he hasn't played one full major league season or minor league season since he dislocated his thumb after the Fisher game. And, you know, it's like, I don't count, you know, 58 games out of a 60 pandemic season, a full season.
Yeah.
Right. But and I think he's making a mistake. He should have had that shoulder surgery last winter. If he had that shoulder surgery, he probably wouldn't have been on the motorbikes and fallen off and broken his wrist. I just think he's absolutely immature. And he's got all the talent in the world, as you point out. And the Padres didn't need to sign him to a 13-year, $300 million contract. It was absurd. They put so much pressure on the kid because what sometimes baseball management doesn't understand is that guys wind up having to play up to the contract. If they had just paid him a couple of million and then gets to his second arbitration season and extends him out when he's developed a little bit, it would have been a completely different thing. I mean, They played Machado $300 million, and he was a fully developed major leaguer. You know, that's the time you do something like that. Mike Trout made $400 million when he was a fully developed major leaguer who had done something. Tatis hasn't done anything. He's shown signs. That's all. But he has to grow up. And so I think what's going to happen to him is he's going to come back from this wrist injury eventually, and eventually that shoulder is going to rear its ugly head too, because he's got a chronic subflex shoulder, which goes back to his teenage years, and it's always happened. And until he has surgery, it's always going to be that way. They're not going to be able to patch it up. So I think we're only seeing the beginning of all this at this point with Tatis.
Are there any athletes that you've covered that have a similar profile where they are just these, you know, super athletes who have to learn how to play within their own body? I mean, it seems like he's headed towards a reckoning where he's going to have to learn to play more like Manny, where it's controlled and it's in within his own game. I think you're right that he does. I think he's always played like this, but you know, with the contract, he is trying to be Superman out there, and it's going to hurt him. He's going to have,
I think this is where Bob comes in, you know, with Manny. You know, you go back to his early years with the Orioles, and, you know, he was lucky. He had Buck as the manager back then, and Buck really knew how to control him. And so if Manny stepped out of line a little bit, Buck would pull him back, and he wouldn't do it publicly. If he had to make a comment about him every once in a while, he would. But, you know, Buck has his own style in doing this. And you're going to see Bob handle things. And unless there's a public thing that happens, you know, Bob is not going to misrepresent, and he's not going to lie about it. He's not going to tell you anything either if it's not obvious. And the crack reporters that cover the Padres now don't dig it up. So it's, you know, I think you will see if Tatis can stay healthy, you're going to start to see that development as far as playing outside, you know, to the capabilities of your body. You know, I really can't think of a guy who, you know, at 19 years old, you know, went to the major leagues with this much hype. I do think that, you know, Hahn and Williams and those guys over in Chicago knew something. They weren't going to trade him for Shields for no reason at all. You know, it wasn't like that AJ, you know, robbed the White Sox from this hidden gem. You know, they knew he had some problems. And so they were willing to send him out because at that time they thought Shields was going to be a complimentary part to get them to a division title. and it didn't work out. It's just one of those things. But, you know, there between the youth, the contract, you know, the fact that he's a former major league player's son, I can't think of any comparables to something like that.
Yeah. I just always think about Bryce Harper when he came up, where he was like running into walls, and it seemed like Harper
is a little different because he had anger management issues, which he really did need to grow up. And, you know, he was very young, but, you know, all the stream of managers, you know, whether it was David Johnson or Matt Williams or Riggleman or whoever were managing the Nationals during that period, you know, they had to deal with Harper as a kid. And there was that whole series with Matt Williams there where, you know, he got thrown out of games arguing third strike calls, and his at bat position in the batting order would come around, and he ultimately cost them the game. I know how many times Williams sat down and tried to talk to him about it. You know, Harper would go, yeah, you're right. I'll work on it. And he just wouldn't work on it. So it was just one of those things. He just needed to grow up too. And, you know, that's a little bit different situation. You know, he had very bad anger management issues coming up as young as he did into the major leagues.
Well, you know, overall with the Padres, I mean, do you think that if this season doesn't work out, and there's a many ways that a baseball season can fall apart for any team, no matter who the manager is, I mean, do you think that this should be Preller's last chance, or do you think that, you know, he deserves more chances at it? I mean, he's been here since 2015 and it hasn't really come together, and except for the, you know, the pandemic season. Do you think it all falls back on him if this falls apart?
You'll laugh, but you know, having just come off, you know, living here, covering the Suns on and off many years, I find the Suns and Padres in different sports have a lot of comparables. You know, they've had great talent over the course of the years. They've never really been able to put it together. The Suns have been to the finals 3 times. The Padres have been to the World Series 2x. They're 0-5. You know,
transplant markets too.
Yeah, transplant markets. Obviously, the Suns are about the same age as the Padres. They came into basketball in 68, 69. Padres came in 69. You know, so they're both around 50 years old. You know, they both developed, and really now they own their markets, where you have, you know, people who grew up like yourself, who grew up in San Diego and have been Padre fans, and you've been watching the Padres your entire life. When I started covering the Padres in 1984, that was like their 15th season. Right. You know, so there was a lot of people there, much like Diamondbacks still are now. Diamondbacks came around in 98. It's not an entrenched, you know, population of fans here for baseball as it is for basketball. But like, the Suns just came off this 64 win season. They set a club record. Everybody expected them to play well in the playoffs and get back to the finals and actually have a chance to win the whole thing this year. And it was anything but. They were horrible in two playoff series. Lucky to survive New Orleans. And they probably played the worst game 7 of any game I've ever seen. There are a couple of other comparables, but nothing in this kind of circumstance where the Suns came out, everybody on the team quit. You know, you just don't know what's going to happen. The Padres could have a 110 win season, and then suddenly you get into the playoffs, and because of the matchups, because it's the playoffs, you start to see, you know, who's for real in those situations. You know, they're completely different situations. I mean, to me, like, Machado may be a very good regular season player, like Trey Turner is in LA. He's a tremendous regular season player, but when he gets to the postseason, he starts to choke. And Machado, when he got to the Dodgers and he played in the World Series, he did nothing. I mean, you know, he could be that type of player. Although as one gets older, maybe he rises to the occasion. But you start seeing all of that when you get to those points where, you know, the money's really on the line. So there's absolutely no way of knowing. And getting back to your question about AJ, you know, I think his biggest mistake, as we outlined, was really his choice of managers. I think, you know, no matter what he says to me or says publicly about it, I think he wanted control of an untried manager. And so he kept, you know, bringing those guys in. There really was no reason for him to fire Bud Black when he fired Bud Black. But Bud Black was a very serviceable manager. Was he a great manager? No. Was he going to bring the Padres to the next level? Maybe not. But, you know, the string of people from Murphy to Green to Tingler certainly weren't. They would have been better off keeping Bud Black. But I don't think he wasn't his guy. He didn't have control over Bud. And so he made changes. But now I think what happened was Seidler probably sat down with him. And I don't know this as a fact because, you know, I know Seidler very well, but we haven't had this conversation. So this is just my thesis. I think he sat down with AJ and he said, look, I'm keeping you here. You have like, what, 3 years to go on your contract. I'm backing you 100%, but no more of this stuff with these managers. Get me a real manager. You know, and so I think that's been his biggest problem. His secondary problem, and it's another thing that I've always told him, is he doesn't get a pitcher that doesn't have had an arm injury or Tommy John surgery somewhere along the line, if not twice. You know, Clevinger was a disaster. That trade was a disaster the minute he made it. You know, Paddock was a disaster. You know, of all the pitchers that they've had, Snell has had problems, and he's a guy who's had shoulder problems over the course of the years. You know, Musgrove has been his one guy who's been a pretty good pitcher and a pretty good stable, you know, element in the Padre rotation. You know, and Darvish has his ups and downs. So it's like, I don't think he's been great at putting together, you know, a front end of a pitching staff. And, you know, that's what Seidler is going to really have to look at, because what they've also done is, you know, with Fowler and Seidler and the way they've spent their money, they don't leave a lot of money to pay for pitching either.
Right.
Because of how, you know, when you have all your money in, you know, Manny and Myers and Tatis and, you know, Hosmer, you know, and you go down the Darvish and you go down the list, doesn't give you a lot of money to spend on a lot of other serviceable parts. So you wind up with a lot of garbage around the main players and a lot of pressure on those main players you're paying to produce. And as I told my son when he was playing youth ball, you know, in San Diego as he grew up, you know, it's the only sport where Tony Gwynn was like one of the greatest hitters in baseball history, and he still failed, you know, 74% of the time. You know, every one of these guys you're paying big money to is going to fail. The only one that doesn't is your closer. Your closer has to be effective 98-90% of the time. And the Padres throughout their history have always been great at socking somebody in there who's been a lights out closer. But everybody else, starting pitching is a 50-50, hitting is a 25 to 75% thing. You know, it's like there's a lot of failure in baseball that you have to deal with. And so, you know, it depends on who compensates for who, you know, when they fail. And I just don't think fans really understand that either. They think if you make $18 million a year, you should play to $18 million a year. And it's like Bruce Hurst once told me that the most important thing he learned about signing a big free agent contract with the Padres after being number two behind Clemens in Boston was that, you know, I was a $6 million pitcher and, you know, or I'm a $6 million pitcher now, and I was a $2 million pitcher, and I'm just not a $6 million pitcher. I can't play up to being a $6 million pitcher. You know, guys can't play up to that money.
Yeah.
Interesting. That's very interesting.
I think the fan base is just, they're not going to be able to blame the manager this time. I think that's what Bob Melvin, that's what I like about Bob Melvin the most, is that we cannot just blame the manager, because he's kind of this, he's this unassailable figure in baseball, right? I mean, everybody has likes him. It's not, yeah,
except for the fact that unlike Bochy, who won 3 world championships, right, Bob's never won anything.
Yeah, that's true.
I don't think, you know, he won, you know,
isn't he on the bench with the Diamondbacks?
He won, you know, like a division with the Diamondbacks, but they got swept by the Rockies in the championship series. So he never hasn't won, you know, a pennant, hasn't won a world championship, didn't do it with the A's. So, I mean, that's the one kink in his resume, that, you know, that he hasn't taken the team, and for various reasons. I mean, some of it not being his fault whatsoever. You know, it's just dealing with organizations that have had a limited amount of resources to spend on players. You know, this is the first time where he's gone to an organization where, you know, hey, last year the Padres paid as little, even though it was minor, they paid a little bit of a luxury tax. They and the Dodgers are the only teams to pay the luxury tax. And who would ever think that about the Padres? You know, I talked to, you know, John Moores, the former owner of the team all the time, who, you know, almost spent up to the Yankees in 1998 to put together a team to win the pennant that year, in the year they were with the, you know, that the ballpark initiative was
the vote, yeah.
You know, and they needed a good showing that year. But, you know, he's aghast at the amount of money that Seidler has paid, because it just, there's too many variables to spend that kind of money when it doesn't work out.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting you bring up John Moores. You know, he's an important figure in our lives. Travis and I are pretty close in age, and you know, it's, you know, he buys the team when I was 14, and he basically steps aside from control when I'm about 30. You know, you wrote something for Forbes right after David Stern died, where you interviewed John Moores, and you know, I didn't really know a whole lot about this, but I didn't realize that he was pretty active in conversation with David Stern for many years about potentially getting into the, some would say, one of the most exclusive clubs in sports, is becoming an owner of an NBA team. Do you think that'll ever happen in San Diego, or is it even a possibility? Yeah. Okay.
You know,
that off. Yeah, no. No, I know it's pretty tough, but you know, I think
Moores, you know, Moores had, you know, the Rockets. He's, you know, from Houston. He wanted the Rockets. You know, he had Stern's blessings. And then he got into a fight over with the former owner who was selling it to him, wanted 4 season tickets or something near courtside as part of the sale. And Moores had a fit and killed the deal. And he goes, boy, that was smart, wasn't it? You know,
yeah.
he really didn't want a baseball team. He wanted an NBA team. And he made pretty good, you know, offer to keep the Sonics in Seattle, too. But David went with the Oklahoma City group, because I think he had a promise with them based on how they helped New Orleans franchise out during Hurricane Katrina. And the team played in Oklahoma City for a while. So there were a lot of variables to that. But, I mean, Moores has looked at those teams. And, you know, the big problem with San Diego is a sports arena. You know, you can't, you know, where the sports arena is now and that building, it just spits out teams. And it's not, it's like the Nassau Coliseum, really. It's that era type of building. You know, you're not going to put an NBA team or an NHL team in that building. And I think, you know, you're going to need a brand new sports arena. But because of the way that's structured in San Diego, in the city and the county, you have to have the management lease on that building to build a sports arena anywhere in the county. You can't have competing sports arenas. I was just talking to Moores about this the other day, you know, because they've been talking about maybe building another sports arena at over by, you know, Snapdragon Stadium,
right.
parking lot there. Mm-hmm. And I said, well, you can't just build a sports arena. You have to have the agreement, you know, with the city. And that's a contract that's written out and is usually about 10 years old. You'd have to buy that from whatever company owns it at this point. And this point, it's like the Hahn family and Ballard Smith, the former owner, the president of the Padres is involved in it. You'd have to buy them out or have them involved in it. It's just a complicated process. So, and actually, I think an NHL team would do much better in San Diego than an NBA team. I always thought San Diego is a pretty good hockey town. When I first got there in the mid-70s, the Western Hockey League had six teams in it. San Diego, they'd sell out the sports arena every night. And, you know, Breitbart, who owned the lease on the arena at that time, and the Rockets, what he wanted was to jump up to the NHL for an expansion team. And when he applied, the NHL went to Seattle and Kansas City, and then Breitbart lost interest in the arena and the Rockets, and the whole winter sports scene in San Diego fell apart because of it. If the NHL had gone to San Diego it was like around 67, 68, you know, because they went to Seattle, that franchise never materialized. Kansas City was a debacle. You know, that one team went to Colorado and on to New Jersey, where it is now. If they had gone to San Diego, you'd still have the Rockets. Rockets would have never, they did perfectly well in San Diego. They had Elvin Hayes. That sports arena in that early era, they had the NCAA finals there. UCLA won a championship there. You know, they had the NBA All-Star game there. They had Republican convention there. You know, in its early stages, that was a really nice building. But, you know, it would have been replaced by something new because you would have had the anchor tenants to do it. But now you don't have anchor tenants and nobody's going to put that kind of money into a building.
Yeah. Well, that's fascinating. I just wonder what it would have happened if John Moores had just given those guys seats, right? I mean,
never would own the Padres.
Yeah, I know. He's such a fascinating character to me. He seems very unknowable, at least for people like us. I don't know. It seems like you know him pretty well. I mean, do you overall with his experience with the Padres, is he overall proud of everything that he did and happy about it? Or does he have any regrets?
I think, you know, Seidler and those guys should kiss the ground that he walked on, because they would not have Petco Park if it wasn't for him. You know, and Lucchino gets undue, you know, credit for it. And I don't take anything away from Lucchino. And he was part of the whole early process of it and the design of it. And, you know, he had his experience with Camden Yards and he came in here. But, you know, Lucchino was fired. You know, Moore saw that thing through 16 lawsuits. 16 nuisance lawsuits. There's a lot of guys who wouldn't have done it. They would have just folded up. It sat there dormant for 2 or 3 years because they had to get through the lawsuits. And, you know, and he persevered and he basically won every one of those suits. And in the end sued, you know, Bruce Henderson and Geary for the nuisance lawsuits and won and collected like a dollar damages. That's all he wanted. All he wanted was to win the suit to prove that he was right. And so, you know, they built a fantastic ballpark, which kept the team in San Diego forever. You know, that's his legacy. And I know there are some stupid people in San Diego who think it's not fair that he's still collecting money from the ballpark village around it. But that was part of the deal, you know, to sign that deal with the city. City didn't want any part of it. So basically, he had to develop a 20-block, square-block, you know, ballpark village around Petco as part of his deal. And, you know, if the city had been left to its own devices, the East Village probably wouldn't look that way. You'd have a standalone ballpark there, just like you have in some other cities, you know, like you have in Miami at this point. You know, it's he invested in it. He sold off property. He still owns a good part of that property around there, you know, and if it wasn't for him, you wouldn't have had that part of the city. It's just amazing, you know, what he did. Mm-hmm. And the team went to the playoffs, what, four times under him.
Yep.
You know, and essentially he spent money. He had basically one or two managers, one general manager. You know, Towers was his general manager practically the whole time. Right. Coach was his manager the whole time. And they had that's probably the most successful period in Padre history. So, yep. You know, I don't know what fans in San Diego, you know, are worried about. I mean, yeah, his divorce was costly. And because of the time it happened, you know, 2008 was the recession. He couldn't borrow the money that he needed so he could buy his wife, ex-wife out of the franchise. Uh-huh. So he had to sell the franchise to give her 50%. Yeah. You know, that's what happened. So, yeah, he should be the Padre Hall of Fame is just stupid. I mean, you know, that Lucchino is going in before Moores. Are you kidding me?
Yeah, that's kind of weird.
You know, but
yeah.
Jack McKean is in there before Ballard Smith. Ballard Smith, without Ballard Smith, I'm working on a book on it.
Yeah,
Ballard Smith, he's responsible for signing Garvey, signing Gossage, and putting, you know, Nettles in a Padre uniform. Without him, none of that stuff would have happened. And without mm-hmm. him dealing with Joan Kronk, none of that would have happened. So, I mean, and he's not in the Padre Hall of Fame. His right. team went to the World Series. What am I missing here?
Yeah. I mean,
it is strange.
Throw in Bob Chandler, too, while we're at it. I mean, come on. What are we doing?
Yeah, Bob Chandler. I love Bob Chandler, but you know, the Leitner is going in over Bob Chandler is a good thing.
Yeah.
Hey, you know, Barry, thanks a lot for coming on. This is fascinating stuff. Yeah, we'd love to have you on again sometime. Maybe we could talk about whether or not the Suns should have extended DeAndre Ayton or something like that. I want to get some Suns chat going.
They spent all that money on Chris Paul, which is going to be
dead
money too. You know, it's because, but you know, Paul looked every bit of his 37 years old. In that Dallas series, so it's like, yeah, they'll probably sign. I would think they will sign. They will sign Ayton. You know, Jones is a really good GM. He has built a really good team there. And Monty's a really good coach. I think they'll, you know, they're not going to flush away Ayton because they have nobody to replace him with.
Yeah. Well, if San Diego gets an NBA team, this podcast becomes an NBA podcast immediately. But well, hey, thanks for coming on, Barry, again. You can find his work at Sportico, which is associated with it's part of Variety, correct? That's how
it's actually the Penske Media Corporation. Okay. We have, and that's, you know, that is Roger Penske's son, Jay Penske, and we have Variety, we have The Hollywood Reporter, we have Rolling Stone. There's like 20 publications.
Oh, okay.
You know, the Sportico was their first foray into sports, and so far developing very well. You know, we haven't even been up for 2 years yet, and it's been it's going great guns. You know, it's been a lot of fun, and you know. Awesome. Always talk Padres. It's like I know too much about the Padres. It's like every time I say, you know, it's like every time I want to get out of the Padres, they draw me back in. And I told Seidler, you know, I'd like to see them win a World Series before I die. I actually would like to see them win the World Series. You know, maybe some fans wouldn't believe that, but you know, I do. And you know, with Peter and his battle with lymphoma, you know, I'd like to see, you know, them win while he's still healthy too.
Great.
Awesome.
Well, you can follow Barry on Twitter @Boomski. I think a lot of you know that, Yeah. Hey, man. Thanks again for coming on. And Travis, do you have anything else? Are we?
Hey, I just appreciate it. And go Padres.
Yeah, let's go keep Padres.
The street going.
Keep the faith.
Hopefully, we'll see you in October.
All righty.
All right.
Thanks, man. Good night. Bye.